Well, the International Year of the Peace is a kind of funny thing, isn't it, really? You can't argue against peace. People want to have a peace march, or people want to have a demonstration, an exhibition of peace, or everybody stands still for a minute for peace. I mean, arguing against peace is like arguing against motherhood and apple pie, isn't it? I mean, it's just a ridiculous notion that someone is going to disagree with you. It's an ideal which everyone will uphold, everyone will sign for. You'll sign a petition, do you want peace in the world? Yes, I'll sign here. You can give my right address and phone number for that one. And you're fairly safe at that point, aren't you? But peace. But the whole problem is not that people want peace or don't want peace. The problem is actually the performance activity of humanity, isn't it? We are warmongers. That is the character of mankind. The history of this time of peace that we are enjoying at the moment is a history of warfare. Since the Second World War, North America and Australia are the only two countries that haven't had a major international war. It's very hard for Australia to have a major international war unless Queensland really does go out in its own. And North America, you really only got Canada and the United States having a go into each other. But, I mean, if you're going to include Mexico and North America, well, they've had major international wars too. So, you really, warfare is just part and parcel of our life. It's part and parcel of what you read in your newspapers, see in your television. The world continues to be at war. And this is one of the most peaceful periods we have ever enjoyed. It's the character of life. Now, for most of us, we'll say, yes, we don't like it because we are the little pawns. We are, by and large, not the people who declare war or declare peace or move multitudes of soldiers out into this flank or to that flank to undertake it or press buttons and fire off anything. We're not that. We're the pawns. We're the people who get shot up. We're the people who get killed and buried and tortured and maimed. We're the little people. We're the ones who actually suffer the consequences of war. So when we sit and discuss peace and discuss war, we're discussing an issue which, to a large extent, we really have got no control over. We're the victims of them rather than the agents in them. I mean, it's very little to do with what we want or don't want concerning Lebanon or Iraq and Iran or Ireland or Chile or anywhere else. What the little people want, the last consideration involved in the whole exercise. And warfare is something that we can discuss endlessly because we have no power to come to any conclusion. I mean, I'm sure that we should have it as part of the arts faculty. It's a good discussion. It goes on endlessly and can never be marked wrong. Now, the problem, though, really, for warfare is that you and I wage war at a completely different level, the level at which we live. There is the problem. It's not just the big problem out there which we can discuss in principle and not do anything about. It's the problem in here that we are engaged in, because it really is just a different size, magnitude, the same problem, though. The problem at home, the problem with my parents or with my spouse or with my neighbours, the problem I have with the tax department or the school or the university or the bank tellers, ones I particularly have problems with. The problems of disagreement, the problem of hatred, of hostility, of action, and the consequences of the little warfares that we are all engaged in are equally terrible. The consequences of enmity are terrific. The loss of health, or sleep, or sanity, or friends, even life that takes place from that kind of warfare. The person who is most likely going to kill you is a person that you're living with. The other one, that is where most murders actually take place. It's within the family context. It's a dreadful thing, isn't it? But it's the character of the life that we're involved in. It's the people, I mean, we can get on with mankind, it's just getting on with our flatmates is the problem, isn't it? Charlie Brown's one was that many years ago. I love humanity, it's just my next door neighbour I can't stand. Warfare really brings to us great discomfort and anxiety and pressure, the pressure of life. The past is thrown up because in the warfare it's all unresolved. You said, or you should have said, or you didn't say, or you did, or you should have done, all gets raked over and over and over, and as you go away after each interlude, you rake it over yourself as to what was said or what wasn't said and what was meant and what wasn't meant. And the past never seems to be fixed up as we go on in our struggles, in our interpersonal difficulties. Then the future, well, the future is uncertain as long as warfare continues. You're never sure who's going to win. You're never sure that if you win, there'll be anything left over to win at the end. You're never sure whether the relationship can ever actually be repaired so you can go back into the friendship you used to have, or whether these things, these terrible things that you've done and said and the warfare will continue. The future remains uncertain, although it is generally bleak. And so you take the issue further and further down the path of force, and the stakes get higher and the problems become greater. You take it to law. It's a dreadful mistake. A couple of friends I know, of people I know, acquaintances I know, one took a next-door neighbour to law because the tree that had been growing on the other side of the fence got into all their sewerage works and destroyed the sewerage works. It cost thousands to repair it, and so they sued their neighbour over it and all the rest of it. Another one, there's a fight over the inheritance and whether which will was the right will and not right will. Both occasions, the people I know went to law on the subject. It was a fight. In each occasion, it took 4 or 5 years to resolve. Much bitterness, much hatred, much antagonism and all the rest of it. Both occasions, they lost the case. They not only lost the case, they had to pay for the court costs of the other person, and both actually went into bankruptcy. But for years, they fought out this issue. For years they lived with the hostility and the hatred and the bitterness and the legal costs and letters. But it's true of all warfare. The consequences are dreadful. The consequences for ourselves, between any war between one person and another, and likewise between man and God, the consequences are dreadful to be at warfare. We tend to resent God. We resent his intrusion upon our lives. We reject his authority to tell us what we should be doing. We do not rejoice in his presence, but rather we hate even the very mention of his name. I see that tonight there's going to be a lecture on Satan put out by some group as I walked up the Basser stairs. Some group whose name I cannot remember now, the Skeptic Society or something or other, are going to preach against God tonight. It's very interesting, isn't it? All the kinds of different things that people will speak about and for. We are one of the very few groups of people that others will organise meetings against. You haven't got anyone organising a meeting against the peace rally, have you? You don't do that. But against God, who is the God and author of all peace, oh yes, let's lecture for Satan. See, there is an antagonism that flows between mankind and God. An antagonism which is mutual, because God is angry with us as he awaits the final destruction. And so our past is one that we feel of as being in guilt. Our future is one, if we know of God's plan for destruction of the world, our future is one of hopelessness. And our present is that purposeless trivia by which we can avoid thinking about God as much as we possibly can. Our present is the self-centeredness, because we've established ourselves as God in our own little life, and therefore we're living for ourselves. Our present is filled with the materialism of a materialist philosophy, of living for faster, better, brighter, bigger, newer, cleaner, shinier, whatever object it may be. Our present is filled with the meaningless trivia of the materialist, mindless, moralist society that we are now in. And so we suffer in our lives, in disease and in antisocial chaos, and in death. That is the character of the present, because we're at enmity with God. And it's the last few weeks that have spelt those out in the early chapters of Romans, but chapter 5 of Romans starts on a different line. Chapter 5 kicks off on peace. Do you ever see the film footage of London at the end of the Second World War? You know, the night that peace is declared, and there's all these stiff, kind of reserved, inhibited English people dancing in the streets like as if they're South Americans. Right? Thousands of them crushing around, hugging each other, shouting, throwing their hats in the air, dancing and enjoying for the peace that had come. Well, Romans chapter 5 reminds me of the peace of London at the end of the Second World War, the sheer exhilarating joy of it all. It kicks off in this positive note. Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. Peace comes because we are justified. Peace with God, that is, comes because we are justified. The judge whom we offended, God, has now declared us to be right with him, has justified us. And because it is he whom we have offended, we are now at peace with him. He has declared us right with him because the penalty was paid in full, and so we are at peace with our judge. Peace within the Bible, Paul as a writer, is a Jewish concept. Shalom, as in the college down the way. It's a concept that is positive, not negative. We in the modern world have a sense of peace which is wholly negative. That is, we believe peace is when you're not fighting. Peace is the cessation of hostilities. Peace is when there's no trouble. It's actually a Greek philosophical system of ataraxia that the Epicureans believed in. When the world is untroubled, then we're at peace. But not so the Jewish concept of peace that comes right through Old and New Testaments. It's a much more positive thing. It's not when there's no warfare, but rather when there's love and harmony and good relationships. It's quite a different thing. I'll try and illustrate it in previous occasions. I'll give it another bell because I can't think of a better one yet. Of the difference between living at peace with your neighbour by building a great big fence between him and you, so that you have nothing to do with each other, so that you never fight with each other, you never see each other, you never hear each other, you don't trouble him, he doesn't trouble you, because you've got nothing at all in common except the other side of this massive fence. Now we're at peace in our modern sense of the world. But the biblical idea of peace is where you can live with your neighbour without a fence at all. There's no fence. You don't mind his kids running on your lawn, he doesn't mind your kids running on his lawn. But you're actually at such harmony and peace and good relationships with each other that you don't need fences anymore. See, it's a positive thing of well-being, of happiness, of harmony, of healthy relationship with each other, where you actually care for each other and love each other and are concerned for each other and share with each other. Now, that is the idea that we have here, you see, that we have peace with God. And this has taken place through Jesus. It is his death that has paid the penalty for us so that we can be justified, so that we can have peace with God. And so you'll see in verse 1, it is by faith, that is the faith in Jesus, that we are now put right with God. And therefore, we have come to a position of favour with God. The second half of that sentence, the verse 2, that through Jesus, we have won favour with God. We have come to the standing of grace. He has given us access to God, favourably disposed towards us. Ever been introduced to somebody important? Ever gone into the situation where you've been taken in to be introduced to somebody? There's a character of introduction. Well, that's what Jesus has done. He has introduced us to somebody important. My father, the other day, I was at a funeral a couple of months ago now, for one of my uncles, and there was a famous person at this funeral who knew my uncle for various reasons and knows my father for various reasons. And so my father called me over in order to introduce me to this famous man. That is a valuable thing to be done, you see. And I had to act appropriately. This famous man had had a son and daughter, a grandson and a granddaughter who had been to campus Bible study, so he knew about me already, which was very nice. And he thought favourably because they enjoyed campus Bible study, although they totally disagreed with me. Wonders never cease. You see? And so I actually was introduced to a man who thought favourably of me before I started. Now, what Jesus has done, you see, is introduced us into the presence of God himself, who is now favourably disposed towards us because of what Jesus has done for us. Jesus has paid the penalty so that God's anger against us is turned aside, and so that he welcomes us in as his children, as part of his family, and we have this access with God. That's a marvellous thing, that we've been given friendship with God. Peace with God has been established. The idea is caught up in verses 10 and 11 of the passage in front of us with a beautiful little word, reconciliation. That we have been reconciled. That is, the making friends out of enemies. The making friends out of enemies. We were reconciled to God through Jesus, he says in verse 10. In verse 11, through Jesus, we have received reconciliation. The Christian gospel is not morality, but relationship. It's that enemies have now been made friends. It's not about a rule system that you must keep. It's not morality, it's relationship. Ah, that I could get this through to you, because over and over again, this is the balking point for people. This is the stumbling block. They want to think that they'd like to be Christians, but they're not good enough. They don't keep up to the law. They keep failing, or they feel guilty, or they must do everything perfectly, and they know they don't do everything perfectly, and so you couldn't be a Christian, could you? I don't know how you can say you're a Christian, Philip, because, I mean, how could you be so sure that you're as perfect as that as to be Christian? You see, all those ideas, all those objections, all those problems are the problems of the same problem. It is thinking of Christianity as a morality that you've got to live up to, a set of rules and regulations that you've got to perform and keep perfectly. That's the concept that lies behind it. But the concept of Romans is the concept of relationship, of friendship. Nothing necessarily to do at all with rules and regulations and performance. In fact, you can't do it by performance. If you want to go by the route of performance, we've all sinned. No one will be right with God through obedience to the law, is what he has said back in chapter 3, verse 20. It's not obedience to the law, it's friendship established by the Son of God on your behalf. A friendship to God. He has introduced us to God when God is favourably disposed towards us. We used to be the enemies of God, now we've been made the friends of God through the intermediary work, through the shuttle diplomacy of Jesus himself. That is what it's about. Peace with God, a relationship with God. And of course, that flows out of what we understand as God. You see, if God is a force, an impersonal force, like in Star Wars, on television again for the 65th million time the other night. Hands up those who watched it. Yeah, there's a few sinful people in this room. Even my daughter said, I cannot stand it again. Mind you, she has seen it for 65,000 million times too. She can recite the dialogue. Well, now, in that kind of whole genre of literature, you see, there is the force, isn't there? And what do you do with the force? You don't talk to it. You don't chat to it. What do? You allow it to flow through you. You experience it, don't you? That's what you do with a force. Now, if God is force, then what you do with God is you experience God. You allow God to overpower you, overwhelm you, force you. Or, if God really is the moral absolute, if that's who God is, not a who God is, it's a what is God, a principle, a morality, then what you must do is live up to that absolute, live up to that morality. But the God of the Bible is a person. And what do you do with a person? You have a relationship with a person. That's what you do. And the relationship is one of enmity or of friendship. It used to be enmity, but what Jesus has done has paid the penalty for us so that the angry God will accept us in friendship. And so Jesus has turned the enemies into the friends. Jesus has established peace with God because we've been justified through him. Now, once that is grasped hold of, then you'll see your future is certain. And that's what Paul is arguing about here. In verse 2, because we've been justified by faith, because we have peace with God, because we now have access to this gracious standing in God, because of this, we now rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Back in chapter 3, verse 23, you'll notice that we have all fallen short of the glory of God. We were created in the image of God to rule the world as God's special creation. But we have failed in that. We failed in that right back at the beginning in Genesis chapter 3. We aren't living in the image of God. We aren't living up to the potential for which God has created us, the place to which God has created us, the calling to which God has called us. We're not living up to that. We are failing. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. But now that we've been justified, now that we've been put at peace with God, now we rejoice in the hope of what lies ahead, the expectation we now have, that is, the glory of God, which we had already forsaken. And so we are the people who are sure of our future, sure that we will share now in God's glory. And knowing this, we not only rejoice in it, but we also rejoice in our sufferings. Verse 2, end of it, verse 3 rather, not only so, but we rejoice in our sufferings. See, how do you handle it? How do you handle the hard times of life?
the difficult times of life that you come to. Are these to put you off God? Are these to say, oh, God can't be God. Look, I'm having a terrible rough time here. Well, I can't wind up in the glorious state to which God has created me. Look at the state of life that's here. No, it doesn't shake our future at all. You see, if you believe the world has no future, that you really have no future other than the grave, that entropy is the end point of all things, if that's what you believe in, then any form of suffering is the ultimate cruelty, isn't it? It's only an accident I'm here. It's all meaningless and purposeless. And the whole time I'm here, I'm suffering. And that's the cruelest barb of the lot, isn't it? I mean, if it was all pointless and meaningless, I might as well have it nice. Fancy having it nasty. A meaningless nasty. Much better have a meaningless nice, isn't it? And it's a terrible thing. If you think the world is uncertain, you're not sure whether actually it's going to be good or bad in the end, then every time you suffer, you start to be assured of the failure, don't you? You start to be sure bad is what is going to win. Suffering is the ultimate end. Evil and pain, that is the victory. But when you know the assurance of the future, that the victory lies in the hand of God and that I am called to share his glory for eternity, when that is my future, what do I do with suffering? Well, suffering is only a process, it's only part of what God is doing to bring me to that glory that he's promised. And so suffering, what does it do? It produces perseverance in me. And what does perseverance produce in me? It produces character. And what does character produce in me but more hope for the future, which will never be disappointed? You don't grow muscles lying in a warm bath. It's not the way to do it, is it? That is the way for atrophy of all muscles, isn't it? You don't grow character by wrapping up your children in cotton wool. That is not how you, that's how you create spoiled brats. You don't gain perseverance quickly, can you? I used to pray that God would give me patience quickly and humility without humiliating me. Very hard, those things, you see. If you're going to be a person of perseverance, of patience, of character, of strength, then it's in the exigencies of a difficult, suffering world that you are going to come to that maturity. And God is at work in these difficulties that are in our world to bring to us that maturity of Christian life, which will be part of our sharing in the glory of God. And so we don't see suffering as a defeat. We don't see suffering as the ultimate nasty. We see suffering as something that God is at work in to produce in me the glory that he's working at. We are hoping, we are sure of the future. But can we be certain? Is this not just a kind of matter of rethink when faced with difficulty? Am I not conning myself? Can I be certain that hope will not disappoint me? And the answer is yes, I can, because of love. God's love poured out into our hearts. God's Spirit has been given to us to teach us God's love, to show us God's love, to reassure us that God loves us. Paul hasn't mentioned the Spirit very much in this book so far, and he won't really be mentioning much of the work of the Spirit till chapter 8, but already he is indicating what will come later. That God's Spirit is given to us to persuade us of the truth of the gospel that God loves us. But that subjective knowledge that I have, that reassurance that I have that God really loves me, is not just a subjective conning of myself. It's a subjective assurance about an objective event. It's a subjective reassurance about something that's happened out there. What is it? God's love. God's love that has been demonstrated. Beautiful word there, beautiful verse in verse 8. God demonstrated his own love for us in that while we were yet sinners, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It brings it out more clearly. That's the idea of demonstrated. It's the same word used back in chapter 3, verse 5. Our righteousness, if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly. It's the same word. The idea God's love is brought out clearly for us to see. Where? Why? How? What kind of love? What is it about? That while we were powerless, verse 6, weak, while we were powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Or verse 8, Christ died not for the righteous, not for the good, not for the friends of God, but for the sinners. While they were sinners, while they were weak, while they were ungodly, is the most incredible and marvellous verse. Really is the verse to be learning, verse 8 of chapter 5. God's love. You want to understand what God's love is about? There it is. That's where he demonstrated it. It is marvellous, you see. His love takes the initiative. He doesn't wait for us. He starts off after us. It's got marvellous timing to it, God's love, hasn't it? When did God love us? When we were sinners. When we were in rebellion against him, when we were at enmity, and when we're shaking our fist and saying, rack off, God, we don't want you, then he is loving us. And so his love is characterized as being the love of the unlovely, of the unlovable, of the unworthy. I mean, anybody can love the lovely and lovable, but to love that which is totally unworthy, that which is totally hostile to you and rejecting you and despising you and despised by you, yet loving them. And not in word, but in deed, at great cost. Oh, anybody can say, I love you, I love you. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy, says the book of the Proverbs, and faithful the wounds of a friend. Anybody can go around kissing. Anybody can go around saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. That's politicians' talk. And that's a nothing, isn't it? Cheap. God shows his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Why? You may sometimes, at a rare moment of enormous courage and possibly stupidity, lay down your life for a friend or for a very good man who is deserving of it. Somebody who has got the cure of cancer in his pocket, and so you say, well, look, you take the parachute because the world needs you. I'll go down with a plane. I mean, just on those rare occasions, your nobility may get the better of you. That's a possibility. But God dies for his enemies. He dies for the worms, you and me, for rotters, for the iniquitous, for the ungodly, for the weak and the powerless. That is who he lays down his life for. Oh, the kings, the rulers, the princes of this world, they lay down the lives of their people for their kingdom, don't they? But not our God, not our king. He lays down his life for the people and dies for them even when they're in rebellion against him. See the cost of God's love? It is an enormous cost, isn't it? His own son should not be spared. But leaving his inherited glory should come and live and die and be cut off from his father for us. When I was a kid, I had the enormous privilege of going to Sunday school. Not everybody has that privilege, but I did, and I'm always glad for it, really. It's an enormous privilege. And when I was there, I was taught many songs. I'm going to share two of them with you today, and for your benefit, I'm not going to sing them. One of them was this one. Went this way, you see, and I didn't understand it until many years later. How greatly Jesus must have loved me. How greatly Jesus must have loved me. To bear my sins. To bear my sins in his body on the tree. I used to sing it with gusto and a voice like mine. That's the only way you can sing. The words didn't mean much to me. It was just a set of all kinds of words you sing as a kid. They just tell you this is what you sing now, number 45, so off you go and sing it. Because you see, when you're forgiven little, you love little. But if you've been forgiven much, then you love much. And when I came to know Jesus Christ as the one who died for me, then I saw how greatly Jesus must have loved me to bear my sin in his body on the tree. Have you ever taken the initiative to make friends with people after there's been a spat? It's pretty difficult, isn't it? To actually be the first person to kind of fix it up. Especially when you know, in fact, you're innocent and they're the guilty one. Pretty hard, isn't it? And it's even harder when it's going to cost you something too, isn't it? It costs God his own son. That's love. And that is what the Holy Spirit has taught us subjectively, what God has demonstrated objectively in the death of his own son. And so, therefore, says Paul, our future is assured. Because if God can do something like that for us, what is it that he won't do for us? If God will not spare his own son, then surely we are safe and secure for the future. The argument here follows the line, if God will do the harder, he can do the easier. For if God makes peace with his enemies while they're enemies, what will he do for us now that we're his friends?
If Christ died to bring peace to his enemies, what will he use his life for but to save his friends? See it in verse 9. Since then we have been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if, when we were God's enemy, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, having become his friends, shall we be saved through his life? You see, my future is now assured. It is now certain. Shall I face the wrath of God? No. For I have been paid for. I am the friend of God. There is no way I need fear eternal punishment. And so, my future is transformed. My future is radically transformed once I've gathered that. So my present is transformed now that I've gathered that my future is assured. You know what the future holds? The way you live in the present is different. First thing is, I have peace. Peace with God. My peace with God is not just down the track in the future. My peace with God is now, because I have now been brought into this gracious standing with God. I have now been introduced to him. I'm not just working towards it. It's available now to be in harmony with your creator, your ruler, your judge, your God. And so I rejoice, says Paul. We rejoice in our hope of the glory. It's the great Christian emotion, joy. There are other words that use which we have an emotional connotation to, like love and peace, but they're not fundamentally emotions in the biblical literature. They have an emotional side to them, but they're not fundamentally. See, love's a funny word, isn't it? Very funny word. You can talk about, you know, I love cabbages and I love my wife. You know, those two things are different. Both cabbages and my wife, and my love for cabbages and my love for my wife. And I generally don't get them confused. But it shows you the problem with the word love, doesn't it? You talk about the many loves of Elizabeth Taylor. Oh, what on earth does that mean? Is that like cabbages? Who could tell? Now, what is the... We have it as a primary emotion. You know, it's got to do with feeling good towards or something like that. But you see, the love of God's not that, is it? The love of God is an action. The love of God is self-sacrificially laying down your life on behalf of the other person. That's the love of God. Now, it has an emotional side and aspect to it, but it's not fundamentally an emotion. Likewise, peace. You see, we think peace is this nothing, is this calm. And so if I'm at calm, then I'm at peace. Just provided I feel within myself no trouble, no anxiety, no warfare, that means then that I'm at peace. Because that's a nonsense peace, isn't it? I mean, you can get that through bombing out with drugs, can't you? When you're really not in peace with the harmony of the world at all, you're not in any good relationships with anybody, you can be actually quite around the bend. Right? But you're at peace, you think, because you're feeling good. And it's not the kind of peace that is being spoken of here. It's not an emotion like that. But joy is. Joy is just unadulterated emotion. It's the exhilaration, the exaltation, it's the bragging, the boasting, it's the feeling of exhilaration when your team wins the grand final. It's the feeling of being on top of the world when you get the marks in the HSC that you wanted to get. It's the reverse of a feeling that you have when you don't get the marks that you wanted to get. Right? It's that reverse of that disappointment. It's that, in a bad sense, it's boasting about myself, bragging about myself. But in a good sense, it's boasting and bragging about God and his victory. It's being excited in him and what he has done and the circumstances. My joy is in the glory that awaits us, the glory of God. And so our present is one of hopefulness. That's not the mood of our day. We're not living in uncertainty. We're not living in bleak despair. We're not living in anxiety. We're living in hopefulness. Our joy is in the hope of the glory that comes before us. Oh, our society is full of people who live in terrible pessimism, don't they? I mean, you can take it philosophically, if you like. The existentialists, Sartre, Camus, and the Theatre of the Absurd, and Beckett, and all that mob of people. It's all meaningless, stupid, futile, boring, terrible, pessimistic. It's only getting worse and worse and worse. The whole doom raiders, you know,
the zero population growth people's discussions, they were out of fad these days, saying we've all discovered zero population accidentally because it suits us. But the whole idea of the world population, Malthusian terms, is just booming out. The whole anti-nuke people, everything's despair, despair, gloom and gloom, right? There's a character. Christian, I like that. We know what the world is about. We know the future. We know it's assured. It's assured in the hands of God. Therefore, we can live in hopefulness. Oh, but there are other non-Christians who live in hopefulness. The humanists, they live in hopefulness. They're always optimistic, aren't they? They're not the pessimists. The world is good and getting better. And they don't need God for that. They're just arguing from facts of life, from the facts of nuclear wars and from the facts of... the facts that are before them all would teach you pessimism. The humanists are really schizophrenic. They face facts and then live without them at the same time. How could you really think mankind is good and getting better given the last 100 years? Where are the signs that man is somehow improving between the First and Second World War? Or the Second World War and Vietnam? Or Kampuchea, where one third of the population's wiped out in just 3 years by Pol Pot and his bunch of thugs? I mean, there's mankind getting better, isn't it? You wonder how bad it was before. I mean, the optimist has got no grounds for optimism. Not in this world like that, but in God. Oh, the Christian, you see, is a hopeful person, not a pessimistic person. Because even though we may go through the sufferings of life, like everybody else, we see that it's different. As old Wesley used to say, see how our people die well. Christians die better than other people because we're not fearful of death like everybody else, because we know what death holds. It's interesting how in Russia they still turn back to Christians when they die. 98%, I think it is, of Russian funerals are conducted by Christianity in the atheist state. No, we actually have a message about death that the humanist has got nothing to say. Oh, ours is a joyfulness then, you see. A joyfulness even faced with suffering. We can be joyful. We know how to suffer. That's a strange kind of claim to fame, isn't it? But we do. Solzhenitsyn, you see, was locked up in the Russian camps for many years, and what he wrote up later is the Gulag Archipelago. And he noticed there that the political idealists all caved in, whereas the Christians stood firm. He himself went in as a political idealist, and he came out as a Christian, because he saw that political idealism could not stand the fierce pain and suffering of torture within that system, whereas Christians could go on in the face of suffering. Paul and Silas, 1900 years before, were sitting in a jail, a different part of the world, at midnight. What are they doing but singing psalms and hymns? Now, I'm not saying that for Christians it's all we move into fantasy land. Suffering, suffering. Hurt hurts. Pain is pain. I hate it like anybody else does. We're not saying that what we are the fantasy land people, you know, I mean, shove some more needles under my thumbs. I love it. I love it. Right? I mean, it's all kind of a masochistic trip for those who really like to suffer. But I'm saying we're not overwhelmed by the suffering of this world that can be inflicted upon us. Depressed and resigned about its hopelessness and meaninglessness, because we know that God is at work in our world. God is at work in us, and our future is assured, and therefore we've got a capacity for coping with the problems of this world joyfully, hopefully, because we know that we are loved. We know the love of God. We know that we are loved just as we are, which of course is exactly how people want to be loved, isn't it? I want someone who will accept me for what I am, as I am, and God himself has done that. Because he died for me not when I got better, but when I was weak and helpless and ungodly and sinful. That is when he died for me, my second song. After Sunday school, I used to go to my grandma's for lunch. Dear old Sausage, who's long since dead. And she had over her mantelpiece this little kind of wood-carved plaque, which she, typical of her generation, loved enormously because of its crass sentimentality. And it said, there's only one, sorry, they said, the perfect friend is the one who knows the worst about you and loves you just the same. There it was. Every Sunday lunch I used to sit underneath, the perfect friend. One day I went to Sunday school and they taught us a new chorus.
I don't know whether they picked it up from them or them from there, but it ran like this, you see. The perfect friend's the one who knows the worst about you and loves you just the same. There's only one who loves like that, and Jesus is his name, his wonderful, wonderful name. Well, I got home to Grandma's quickly that week, sung it to her loud and clear, because she obviously didn't have it right. I don't know what she made of that, really. Early attempts at my evangelism. Well, you see, it's great truth in whoever picked up that chorus. Great truth in it, you see. Who else really knows me as I really am? All about me, all the bad bits. No one but God. And who is it that loves me just as I am, knowing it all? But only God. So that means I really am loved. Do you see how that changes the colour of your day? Hey, that changes the character of the existence you're in, doesn't it? And the emotions, and so that great emotion is joy. There it is. The knowledge of this, which is not a feeling. It's taught by the Spirit, but it's out there in history. Jesus died for me. The knowledge of this brings joy to me, joy about God himself. We rejoice, says Paul in verse 11, we rejoice in God. Verse 2, we rejoice in the glory. Verse 3, we rejoice in our suffering. I think it's verses 3 and 4. I've got the wrong numbers. Verse 11, we rejoice in God. You got a friend? No, I hope you got a friend. Lots of people don't have friends, but have you got the kind of person who lights up your day? You know, that when you see them, you feel better for having seen them. When you're in the traffic and you see their car going past, you actually see it there and you feel better even about the traffic just because they're around. You've got that kind of friendship with someone? Because I'm a Christian, I've got that friendship with loads of people, hundreds of people. So one of the advantages of being a Christian is you've got ever-expanding number of people who really are meaningfully friendly to you. But the friendship we have really is even better. We have that experience with God himself. God himself is someone in whom we can rejoice just to know. Marvellous thing, you see. Remember the old days, those of you who are Christians, and those of you who are not, you most likely still in those days. Those old days when what you thought of God was negative, that he was hard, that he was judgmental, that he's kind of like a combination father with a strap in the hand, policeman, school teacher, who is always out to spoil every sport, to inhibit your personality and your joys and your happiness, to harm you and destroy existence at every point. Remember that attitude to God, that feeling towards God, that emotional reaction towards God, because you're actually not a friend of God, isn't it? You're at enmity with God. But now that we've been justified through the death of Jesus on our behalf, we rejoice in God because we know God is not like that. That God is one who is loving and kind and who loves me, who is gracious and generous and who is giving every good thing and who wants the very best for me. He is the friend par excellence, the person that you can turn to and tell your good stories and your bad stories because he's on your side, who actually can light up your day because such is the character of the friendship. We rejoice in God. But maybe you don't, because you really are not at peace with God. So that's my question. Are you at peace with God? It's natural to be at enmity with him, even the enmity of indifference to God. That's enmity. I mean, that's like one of those dreadful, dry, barren marriages which continue on because nobody ever speaks to anybody else. That's the kind of peace you have when there is no interaction. No one said anything over the breakfast table, so no one had a fight, so we're at peace with each other. That kind of married relationship, of course, is appalling to be in, and that's how some people are with God. Oh, they haven't had any bad news from God lately. They just haven't had any news of God lately. And so they're at peace with God in a totally barren emptiness. But you needn't be like that, you see. Because of what Jesus has done for you, you can be justified. No longer have God angry with you. No longer resent and reject God. But you can actually be right with God. And if you're right with God, then you can be at peace with God. And how does that take place? By having your faith in Jesus, who has done it for you. For it is by faith in Jesus that we are justified and have this peace with God. Well,
Where are you in relationship with Jesus?
Inside your outlines today, pink cards again. Last time I think this session we're going to do this. On the back of the pink cards, you'll see the prayer I'm going to close with in a moment. On the front of it, I'm going to talk to you about what to write on the other side. This is the kind of prayer that those who are not at peace with God, those who are at enmity with God, would need to pray in order to get at peace with God. If you want peace with God, if you want to come into that relationship with God through Jesus, then you pray it with me. The quietness of your own mind, pray it to God with me. And afterwards, I'll tell you what to do. Let's pray. I don't know. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called your child. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life, for I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. And I need your forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me that I may be forgiven. And thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me, that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.